This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Rita Dove has said, the post of U.S. Poet Laureate made her realize she was, quote, capable of a larger voice. Two former poet laureates, Billy Collins and Donald Hall, have also strived to use that larger voice to advance the art of poetry in the U.S. Billy Collins' first poetry collection in 3 years, he is titled Ballistics, and Donald Hall's new memoir, Unpacking the Boxes, explores how poetry has shaped his life. Both writers join me here in the studio to talk about their experiences as poet laureates and the future of American poetry in the 21st century. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning.
So glad to have you here. Billy Collins, explain to us what it is that a poet laureate does.
Well, Howard Nemiroff, who was one of our predecessors, probably put it best when he said the poet laureate basically spends his or her tenure explaining what the poet laureate does. It's a little mysterious. In fact, when I got the phone call from James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who is appoints the poet laureate, I felt honored but bemused. I really didn't know what it meant. It sounded good, but there's a very short checklist of duties that the poet laureate performs, largely a reading and a lecture at the Library of Congress. But apart from that, it offers a kind of platform from which to launch, if one is in the mood to, any national initiatives to help raise consciousness about poetry and put a spotlight on it. I started a program called Poetry 180, which was designed to have a poem read every day in American high schools, not studied, not quizzed upon, but just read so I could get some good contemporary poems into the ears of high school students.
And Donald Hall, what is it that brings an individual poet to the attention of whoever it is makes that decision?
You know, my greatest spreading around of poetry happened at first when it was amazing. I got interviewed about 40 times. It was telephone interviews for radio, I went down and did NPR in Concord, which is the nearest public radio to me. And everybody came to me. Los Angeles Times, Sports Illustrated did a whole page on this poet laureateship. Back in Washington, I tried to, we got some distance toward putting a poem a week on a radio station, one of the independent stations that you subscribe to, but it didn't finally work out. And I just spent 1 year as poet laureate doing all the minimum and discouraged that I couldn't do more, feeling that I wasn't going to, you can do 2 years, but I just did one.
Now, did you move to Washington during that year? Did you stay in your own home? How did you operate?
I stayed in my own home and commuted.
I see.
From time to time.
And how often did you come back and forth?
Oh, maybe it was 8 or 9 times.
I see.
Yeah. Not terribly.
And
open.
You, Billy Collins?
Well, it used to be a kind of Washington-based office. I think in the past, poets laureate, which I believe is the plural, that's one thing. That's one thing you learn.
I should have caught that. Poets laureate.
It's like mothers-in-law, not with many differences. It was you would move to Washington. I think the stipend that was the same. It's the same now as it was in 1953. And then you could afford to come to Washington and rent a house and go to the office every day.
See.
Now it's become much more of a national appointment. And I would come down to introduce poets at the poetry series at the library and go to the office occasionally, although I don't remember the phone ever ringing in the office. As Don says, it's more or less commuting back and forth from where you are to Washington, putting in appearances.
Billy Collins, he's a professor of English at City University of New York, where he's taught for the past 30 years. He served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 till 2003. He was named New York State Poet Laureate from 2004 until 2006. Donald Hall was appointed U.S. Poet Laureate from 2006 to 2007. He's received several national poetry awards. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I'd like to get from each of you your sense of where poetry is today. I opened this program by talking about the schism that is or seems to be developing between academia on the one hand, the idea that poetry should be studied and learned and carefully pulled apart for its meaning as well as its rhythm and so on and so forth. And yet, on the other hand, what seems to be developing a kind of populism in poetry. Mm-hmm. Donald Hall.
Well, I contrast so much the present with my youth. Poetry is so infinitely more popular now than it used to be, and people are amazed sometimes when I say that, but they weren't around when I was, when a new book of poems by a well-known poet would come out in 1,000 copies, hardback only. And now, for goodness sake, there are many who will begin with 10,000 copies. Billy will go beyond all the rest of us. We must not envy him. But there are so many poets. One thing that bothers me about the audience is they seem to be more specialized. No common readers. There are the poetry people, there are the sci-fi people, and I think that it's part of the general separation, the automization, that goes together with globalization for something, that parts of the world are separating from other parts, parts of a readership are separating.
Is there, Billy, a schism between the two?
I don't know. I mean, as Don says, the poetry has gotten a lot more popular. To go back to being poet laureate as a way of answering that, I agree. I thought I was going to be the first Christian martyr to be interviewed to death. That's what happens when you're poet laureate. But I got the two most frequently asked questions were, one, how do you account for this incredible renaissance and rebirth of interest in poetry in America? And two, how come nobody reads poetry anymore? And there actually was an answer to both questions, which was, and still is, I think, that there is much more poetry activity happening. I mean, open mic and books being published and more books and MFA programs. So the audience for poetry is expanding, but it is composed largely of other poets or people who have a vested interest in poetry. I think it's almost like, you know, if you went to the symphony one night and everybody in the audience was carrying a violin case, what I think the salutary aspect of what's happening is perhaps poetry is being read by a broader audience. It's a strange world of poetry because the lack of a broad audience is a cause for constant lamentation among poets, and yet it's the same world where commercial success is deplored. So it's really...
Commercial success is deplored.
Well, I think it's thought of as a sign of aesthetic weakness in some way.
Sort in other of words, giving in.
Yeah, so. If it's popular, it can't be good. Because poetry, the ties between poetry and its own neglect are so firmly established.
Right, and that's been true for centuries, really, that part. Yes, I suppose so. I have made my living by freelancing since 1975, and my income may have come 25% from poetry, but that is almost all poetry readings, not the sales otherwise. And I have made my life out by writing prose while I wrote poetry first thing in the day every day. But poetry has been a minor contributor.
But do you see a difference in, if I were to look at your poem, Billy Collins, titled Adage, would I, if I were skilled in understanding poetry, would I classify that as falling under the popular category or the academic category?
I don't know. I think my poems are resist interpretation because they're so transparent. I mean, I think you could read this to a canary and it might have a shot of understanding it. I don't think my... I've heard that, you know, people teach my poems, but I can't imagine what they'd say about it.
But does that make it popular poetry because it's understandable?
Well, I think you want some level of comprehensiveness. I mean, or comprehensibility. One of my favorite analogies for a good poem is that a good poem is like one of the eye charts in the eye doctor's office, where you have at the top this enormous E. Right, everybody can see the E, and then as you read down the lines, you come to this point of illegibility where you have to squint and things are not quite as clear. I like poems to start very clearly like that, and then get more difficult.
Former poet laureate Billy Collins, his new book of poems is titled Ballistics. Welcome back. I'm fortunate enough to have with me in the studio two poets laureate, Billy Collins and Donald Hall. Billy Collins served as poet laureate from 2001 till 2003. Donald Hall was appointed from 2006 to 2007. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Billy Collins, just before the break, I teased the audience with the title of one of your poems. It's called Adage. Would you read it for us?
I'd be happy to. Adage. When it's late at night and branches are banging against the windows, you might think that love is just a matter of leaping out of the frying pan of yourself into the fire of someone else. But it's a little more complicated than that. It's more like trading the two birds who might be hiding in that bush for the one you are not holding in your hand. A wise man once said that love was like forcing a horse to drink, but then everyone stopped thinking of him as wise. Let us be clear about something. Love is not as simple as getting up on the wrong side of the bed wearing the emperor's clothes. No, it's more like the way the pen feels after it has defeated the sword. It's a little like the penny saved or the nine drop stitches. You look at me through the halo of the last candle and tell me that love is an ill wind that has no turning, a road that blows no good. But I am here to remind you, as our shadows tremble on the walls, that love is the early bird who is better late than never.
Billy Collins, can you give us a sense of how you began to write that poem?
Well, I think, you know, poem, we only have a few subjects in poetry. I mean, there's love and grief and separation and joy. And but you're just always looking for new language in which to express these ancient themes. And I just started playing with some cliches. I mean, I think someone said that poetry is a great opportunity to play and be serious at the same time. And the language of poetry is always playing with itself, in a sense. And so I just began with thinking of these maxims or adages. And you know, the obvious subject in poetry is love. And I just, you know, it was fun to just thread through these and try to come out with an unforeseen conclusion.
And Donald Hall, there is an example here that you've written. It's titled An Old Life. Would you read that for us? Do you have that there?
No, I don't have
right,
it. Let I had
me
a book
give
called
it.
The Old Life.
Let me give that
thank
to you,
you
yes. Because I loved it so.
Okay, thank you. Snow fell in the night. At 5:15, I woke to a bluish mounded softness where the Honda was. Cat fed and coffee made, I broomed snow off the car and drove to the Kearsarge Minimart before Amy opened to yank my globe out of the bundle. Back, I set my coffee beside Jane, still half asleep, murmuring stuporous thanks in the aquamarine morning. Then I sat in my blue chair with blueberry bagels and strong black coffee, reading news, the obits, the comics, and the sports. Carrying my cup 20 feet, I sat myself at the desk for this day's lifelong engagement with one task and desire.
That's such an affirmative poem.
Thank you.
Of life and what makes up the daily,
yes,
putting one foot in front of the other.
Absolutely.
I loved it.
I adore routine, especially if the routine begins with writing poems after waking up with coffee. I did it for so many years. I still do some version of it now.
And yet there's another poem that truly struck me titled Affirmation.
Yes.
Would you read that for us?
Affirmation. To grow old is to lose everything. Aging, everybody knows it. Even when we are young, we glimpse it sometimes and nod our heads when a grandfather dies. Then we row for years on the midsummer pond, ignorant and content. But a marriage that began without harm scatters into debris on the shore, and a friend from school drops cold on the rocky strand. If a new love carries us past middle age, our wife will die at her strongest and most beautiful. New women come and go, all go. The pretty lover who announces that she is temporary. The bold woman, middle-aged against our old age, sinks under an anxiety she cannot withstand. Another friend of decades estranges himself in words that pollute 30 years. Let us stifle under mud at the pond's edge and affirm that it is fitting and delicious to lose everything.
Donald Hall reading his poem, Affirmation. Billy Collins, you talked earlier about the few themes that recur in poetry. Certainly death is one of them.
Well, death is the main one. I mean, I've said that, you know, to college students that if they're majoring in English, they're majoring in death. I mean, that is the all-encompassing. Every poem is written in the shadow of death. I mean, because it's mortality that poetry wants to remind us of. I think, you know, if you think like the message of television is often everything's going to be okay. You know, it's a very positive medium. And the message of modern fiction is everything is not going to be okay at all. And the message of poetry is life is beautiful, but you're going to die. And it's that way that death has of italicizing experience, if you will, of making it more vivid and more precious. You know, Wallace Stevens famously said that death is the mother of beauty. And what he meant, I think the way to illustrate that is, you know, if you sit down at a restaurant and there's some flowers on the table and you go to feel them to see if they're real. And if there's silk flowers, suddenly they're not beautiful. The reason they're not beautiful is they're not dying. They're going to be there 6 months from now. So a thing that is dying is capable of beauty. And so the connection between beauty and death is something that poets make a lot of hay about.
Donald, do you agree?
It gets a little more immediate when you hit 80. But let me say, poem I ever wrote when I was 12 years old was, Have You Ever Thought About the Nearness of Death to You? It went on for a few lines. My friends say it's the best thing I ever did.
Why do you suppose at age 12 you were moved to write a poem about death?
I'll try to make it brief. I had the habit of watching, Frankenstein movies, Abbott and Costello made Frankenstein. The boy next door said, if you like that stuff, read Edgar Allan Poe.
Huh.
I read him. I thought, this is the best stuff I ever heard. All that necrophilia, you know, wonderful. So I decided that I would become a poet and a story writer as well. Then when I was 14, somebody introduced me to what was actually going on. To T.S. Eliot and Wallace Stevens and so on, and I had different goals.
What about you, Billy Collins? What was that first poem that you wrote?
I don't know. I remember being about 10 and being in the back of my parents' car. I was an only child, I think, we're both only children here.
Is my husband, by the way, who writes lots of poetry.
Oh, good.
Interesting.
I think poems themselves are kind of like only children. You know, they have a sort of self-sufficiency about them. But I remember I looked out and there was a sailboat there. It was in New York. And I obviously had some kind of literary reaction to this. And I asked my mother for something to write with. And I don't know what I wrote, but I do remember like looking at something and then wanting to react to it verbally. You know, I don't think I was committing an act of literature exactly, but I was, in retrospect, I was doing what poets have done pretty much since Wordsworth, which is to write what is now called observational poetry. You see something and then you say something about it to echo, you know, a kind of post 9/11 warning. You see something, you have a reaction, and you record that. The first example of that is Wordsworth looking at these daffodils and writing down a reaction to it. And we haven't stopped doing that since, 1800.
Here's an email from Jason who says, I think there exists within poetry, nationally speaking, a caste system. There seem to be academics on top, the slam poets next, then an underground scene. The relationship should be symbiotic, but there exists an isolationist behavior for each group to various degrees. Each group attempts to write poems for others in the groups. It becomes quite incestuous after a while. Poets in all groups should actively attempt to make their poems accessible to the wider population, the non-readers. There are many folks that may have been turned off by poetry in school, by Pound, Eliot, etc. It's our job as poets to bring it back to the Sandburg level, to the everyday person. What do you think, Donald Hull?
Oh, I think Sandburg is an absolutely terrible poet compared to Eliot. And what was the other? Stevens?
Pound.
Yes,
Pound and Eliot.
The beauty of sound and the resolution of sound into lines, that is poetry, as far as I'm concerned.
And what's the matter with Sandburg?
Oh, he's hopelessly sentimental. He attempts to be derivative of Walt Whitman, but he doesn't make it because Walt Whitman is a gorgeous poet, a great poet.
Billy Collins.
Well, you know, poetry, there's a huge tent under which a lot of verbal activity is being performed. And I don't want to imply that it's a circus exactly, but the tent is labeled poetry. And there's such a variety of activity that goes on under there. I would just applaud the variety. And I think, you know, we've gotten so far away from the high modernism of Pound and Eliot and Wallace Stevens and Hart Crane. I mean, I went to, you know, a graduate school and got a PhD in English literature and had a great time reading Wallace Stevens and parsing this very difficult poetry. But through the efforts of people like Donald Hull, who edited this wonderful, life-changing anthology for me, New Poets of England and America, I'd never heard of many of these poets until I read that anthology.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about the work of E.E. Cummings? Is that still very much within the poet circle, or has it moved to the outer edge, Billy?
Well, the strange thing about E.E. Cummings is that you can't put together a respectable anthology of modern American poetry without including him. And yet he has no imitators except for middle school children who like to write falling, you know, with the letters falling down the page.
Falling leaf.
Yeah, and falling leaf. And it's interesting. He's the only major poet, I think, who has no imitators beyond the age of 14.
Yeah. Billy Collins, would you read for us The First Night?
Sure. This has an epigraph. It's a sentence from Juan Ramon Jimenez, and it just stopped me in my tracks when I was reading. He says, "The worst thing about death must be the first night." And the poem is called The First Night. And I address Jimenez. "Before I opened you, Jimenez, it never occurred to me that day and night would continue to circle each other in the ring of death. But now you have me wondering if there will also be a sun and a moon, and will the dead gather to watch them rise and set, then repair, each soul alone, to some ghastly equivalent of a bed? Or will the first night be the only night, a darkness for which we have no other name? How feeble our vocabulary in the face of death, how impossible to write it down. This is where language will stop, the horse we have ridden all our lives, rearing up at the edge of a dizzying cliff. The word that was in the beginning and the word that was made flesh, those and all other words will cease. Even now, reading you on this trellised porch, how can I describe a sun that will shine after death? But it is enough to frighten me into paying more attention to the world's day moon, to sunlight bright on water, or fragmented in a grove of trees, and to look more closely here at these small leaves, these sentinel thorns, whose employment it is to guard the rose."
Gosh. That first night.
That's just I started shuddering. I just thought it was a whole, much darker idea of death than I'd ever considered.
And did the poem begin in you almost immediately upon reading that line?
Yeah, because it suggested a hypothesis, which I explored in the poem. And a lot of my poems are based on a kind of imaginary hypothesis. I mean, what if there were night and day after death? Well, that's... You know, poetry's got a lot to do with the if clause, you know, what if something were possible, in the way Alice in Wonderland is. You know, the poem goes down a kind of rabbit hole, and then you explore this other potential world. But again, it's another Carpe Diem poem. You know, it helps you to appreciate the rose better and the thorns.
Would you agree, Donald Hope?
Yes, our friend. Poems... coming out of nowhere with an observation, and it may be the world I look at, and it may be three lines from a Menuth. Certainly, wherever the poem begins, it almost always tends to take me toward death, the appreciation and the horror of death.
Donald Hall and his new memoir of a life in poetry is titled Unpacking the Boxes. He served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 2006 until 2007. Short break. When we come back, your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at FordFoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series of memorable interviews from 2009. Woody Allen will tell us why we shouldn't confuse him with his film persona, and Tracy Morgan, one of the stars of 30 Rock, will talk about growing up in what he calls Ghetto USA. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If you just joined us, two former Poets Laureate are with me, Billy Collins and Donald Hall. Each has a brand new book, Billy Collins' Poems. The book is titled Ballistics, and for Donald Hall, it's a memoir titled Unpacking the Boxes, a Memoir of a Life in Poetry. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Judith in Michigan. She says, I've never been a poetry reader and saw reading poetry as the painful analysis I was required to do in high school and college. I thought poetry was from someone smarter than I to read. Then I began hearing Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac and discovered the joy of listening to the words and enjoying the words and story of the poem, and I thought about it later, not worrying about the mechanics so much. I think Keillor has helped poetry quite a bit with the workshop and his weekly program. Billy Collins?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I don't know if it becomes less smart when you hear it on the radio, but I think Garrison Keillor has probably done more for spreading the word of poetry than anybody in America. I get the thing online every morning, and there's a poem for me, and I figure out, you know, whose birthday it is, and I can write them and mock them, tell them how old they are, and all that. But I think it's a good thing, a poem a day. And, you know, the first introduction we have to poetry is usually in the classroom, and what we encounter there is the intervention of teachers who, you know, bless their hearts, but they tend to stand often between the poem and you. Mm. And to hear the poem simply read is to get it in a more direct way.
Donald Hall.
Absolutely. Garrison Keillor has a marvelous voice, and he knows what he's reading. He knows it as a physical object as well as, I assume, what we would sum up as what, you know what to say in classrooms, what is he trying to say?
Yes, yes,
as if
yes.
The answer were in the back of the book always.
Remember that question.
Yeah. And Keillor never asks that question, never offers a summary or an interpretation. He just lays out the poem for you. When I read silently, I hear every word, and I hear it when I read the newspaper. Thank goodness I don't. It would take me forever, and my ears would get disgusted. I think of a poem as a body which is delivered by the voice, or possibly the imagined voice, when someone is really familiar with poetry. There's a body there that gets across, and if I look back at a poem, I could possibly interpret it. I don't care very much. I care about its authenticity and its beauty.
Mm. All right.
Well, not what it means.
Let's take a call from Leesburg, Virginia. Good morning, Kay. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Diane, and it's a real privilege to hear your show today.
Thank you.
Just to tap into what the discussion has tended to go to today is about the meaning of poetry and whether or not we do need to understand actually what is being written or said. And as someone, as a general reader, I find it sometimes I have to work very, very hard at getting through some pieces. And I try. But I was wondering, do we have to work so hard at it? Certainly, sometimes, you know, after a few times, there's an aha moment and I think it's brilliant, and sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Is that important? When we read poetry, do we need, or do you think as poets and as people who write poetry, do you think that there's really no need to talk about your work or to have more general conversations, and that poetry may be best for, you know, solitary contemplation?
Donald Hall.
Well, the typical poem that I really admire is always saying at least two things at once, and often they're things in opposition, and that is so beautiful, because that is really what our lives are like. No one ever hates exclusively or loves in exclusively. There is always some counter tendency in it. I don't know any other art which in its own language can embody this human ambivalence that is absolutely pervasive. And poetry will do that in its language, in the adjective and the noun coming together. It will do it by the stream and flow of the images and a kind of counterflow. And that's what I love to hear. When I finish a poem, when I finish a draft of a poem, I often don't know what I have said, and often other people tell me. And I say, oh, good, I'm glad I said that.
Billy Collins.
Well, I just add that, poetry is a home for, it's where ambiguity and ambivalence find a home. You know, often in life, we don't want messages to be ambiguous. We want clarity. But someone said that a poet is someone who can't say one thing at a time. And I think when you're a student in early on, that kind of uncertainty is frustrating because you want the poem to be about one thing. As you mature in your appreciation of poetry, that ambiguity becomes a richness. It becomes the texture of poetry.
Donald Hall, you've written a poem titled On Reaching the Age of 200.
Right. I just reached that age last week.
Would you read that?
I wrote the poem.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. On Reaching the Age of 200. When I awoke on the morning of my 200th birthday, I expected to be consulted by supplicants like the Sibyl at Cumae. I could tell them something. Instead, it was the usual thing. Dried grapefruit for breakfast. Mozart all morning, interrupted by bees' wings. And making love with a woman 181 years old. At my birthday party, I blew out 200 candles, one at a time, taking naps after each 25. Then I went to bed at 5:30 on the day of my 200th birthday and slept and dreamed of a house no bigger than a flea's house with 200 rooms in it, and in each of the rooms a bed, and in each of the 200 beds me sleeping.
I love that poem. All right, let's go to Ron in Northern Kentucky. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Thank you for having me on your wonderful show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I just want to say first that I was a rather forgettable student of Mr. Hall back in the late 50s. I remember his kindness. I wrote horrible poetry, but he said to me I'd written more poetry than anyone else in the class, which, of course, he didn't say the other aspect. Yeah, I've always appreciated that. I was also struck by what Mr. Hall said in terms of getting 25% of his income from poetry, but most of it being readings. And it struck me that, is it not true that poetry is an oral tradition? I mean, you look historically. I mean, nobody was reading Homer back then. They were hearing Homer, you know, being recited.
Sure.
People were memorizing poetry. And I remember as a child in school, one of the things we had to do was memorize poetry. And perhaps it wasn't always great poetry, but it was a kind of skill that you picked up. And here in my later years of life, as I wander into that first night, I have started to do that again, where I'm memorizing poetry, and I'm finding that making poetry a part of yourself, that's when it becomes incredibly meaningful, and I think we need to get back into the schools and get our kids doing that.
What do you think, Billy Collins?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think memorization has gotten a very kind of bad name, and it's thought of as, better in the Little Red Schoolhouse, a very old-fashioned way of presenting poetry. And students tend to resist memorization. But once they memorize a poem, they are thrilled that they have internalized this poem. And as the caller said, it actually becomes part of yourself, and it's part of your mental makeup.
It's so interesting. We easily memorize songs. I can remember doing so from childhood on, and yet why that resistance to memorizing poems? Is it because it's sort of forced on you when the memorization of songs simply comes from the beauty of the repetition and the added realm of music?
Well, people assumed that repetition was a bad thing. Because of memorizing the multiplication tables, because of memorizing Amon Masamat, and then they turned it on poetry, and it's no relationship at all. In the small towns of New Hampshire, where I live, sometimes schools still have what began in the 19th century, prize speaking day. And the prize is not for literature. It's for the pleasure given by reading something aloud, the pleasure received by something read aloud, by performance, but also in order to perform very well, I think you need to know. Casey at the Bat is better than a lot of the things I hear at the Prize Speaking Day. I like Casey at the Bat. But rhyme and meter make recitation, make memorization much easier. Mm. Homer did not rhyme, but the meter was gorgeous, and the repetition of vowels within the line in Homer. It's the most musical language ever, and it makes it earlier easier to remember and recite.
To Rochester, New York. Hi there, Roy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for such a wonderful show. I've always felt I was part of the audience, and what I saw in Rochester, I went ahead and photographed a number of poets for a calendar, and when we went to title it, they told me they did not want to be called poets, and after a conclave, they said I should title it a spoken word calendar, and I was wondering what the professors thought of that.
Billy Collins.
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess that's going back to some kind of division between people who indulge in spoken word poetry and then don't even want to be called poets. I'm happy to be called a poet. Although it's, as someone said, it's difficult to call yourself a poet. It's like calling yourself a saint. You know, it's like self-canonization. But you have to wait till thousands of people accuse you of being a poet until you're able to admit it.
Would you resist being called a spoken word artist?
Yes, I would. It's too many syllables for one thing, and I'm not sure what that is.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Billy Collins, you have a poem titled, Oh My God.
Right. It's just a short 9-line poem. It's a reaction to that, the overly popular, ubiquitous expression or exclamation, Oh My God. Oh My God. Not only in church and nightly by their bedsides do young girls pray these days. Wherever they go, prayer is woven into their talk like a bright thread of awe. Even at the pedestrian mall, outbursts of praise spring unbidden from their glossy lips.
Do you write that as criticism, or do you write that as appreciation, or do you write that as simply a distant bystander?
But a distant bystander. I think the tone in that is very important because it's the speaker is naive in a kind of mock way. I mean, he's actually thinking that when he hears girls say, I was like, oh my God, that they're in some way in the condition of prayer. So it's really mocking the speaker as well as the overuse of the expression.
And here's a caller in Sand Lake, Michigan. Gabe, I gather you're a bookseller.
Hi, it's wonderful to speak to you. I am a bookseller. I'm a member of the Poetry Society of Michigan, so I'm active in writing and reading poetry. But I have a used bookshop, and I get customers in weekly looking for poetry. It's either for themselves or for friends or relatives, and they're always looking for something that's you've used this term earlier, accessible, but not simple and fluffy. And that's exactly why I always refer them to Mr. Collins. You know, we've always got several of his books on the shelf, and I've never had anyone come back unhappy with it. And they usually come back and either buy more Billy Collins or just expanding and buying other poets as well.
I'm sure you're happy to hear that, Billy Collins.
The radio audience can't see my grin.
All right, thanks for calling, Gabe. And here's a last question for you both, and it's from Jolly in Norman, Oklahoma, who says, my 15-year-old son asked me just yesterday why they had to study poetry in school, and more particularly, why they had to write it. I'm sure your guests have a better answer than I gave yesterday, and I would like to give my son a better answer. Donald?
It's to allow poetry to get into their lives, but also trying to write poetry really helps you read it. If you never are going to write a good poem, but you work at trying to write it, trying to make it a little better. When you stop writing it, go back and write it over again, you develop the possibility of reading it and taking pleasure in it and having it be part of your life. I believe in them reading it, but I believe in it being taught, as long as it is not taught as some sort of puzzle to which there is a response in a few words that destroys the poem, I'm sure.
Billy Collins.
When I taught literature, when I teach it as a subject matter, even I'm teaching Victorian poetry, I have my students participate, writing 10 lines of iambic pentameter or something, so they can appreciate how difficult it is. I took oil painting classes for a while just to appreciate how difficult that was.
Mm-hmm. Billy Collins, his new book of poems is titled Ballistics, and Donald Hull, his new memoir of a life in poetry is titled Unpacking the Boxes. What a delightful hour, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.